Good evening. Let's try it one more time. Good evening. It's great to have you here this evening. You know, we usually don't make a point to do these kinds of things, but this is special enough. I don't know if you all know, but tonight, on Tuesday, we have a couple in our congregation who are celebrating their 60th wedding anniversary. 60th wedding, not 60 years old, not birthday, 60th wedding anniversary. John and Ora Oliver, and John will probably kill me for actually doing this, but they have been a part of this community even before we were Jacob's Well. They were part of the Roanoke Presbyterian community, and they always sit in the second to last seat in the back. Philip is there, kind of. And John and Ora, if you wouldn't mind just standing up, can we just give them a round of applause? Thank you so much. You know, I don't know if you all know the story, but the real short thing is, like I said, they were a part of Roanoke, and when Roanoke negotiated with the presbytery to sell us this building, John and Ora said to Tim, they said, you know, Tim, if you don't mind, I think we're just going to kind of keep coming here. So we like to say that we bought the building and they came along with it. So it's a wonderful thing. Our grandparents in the faith. So thank you all for indulging me there to do that. He is risen. Thank you. So you all understand, right, that we are still in the Easter season. Within the church, Easter isn't just a one-day event. It's actually a whole season, a series of Sundays that begin with that Easter day, and then that takes us up through Pentecost. And so we're in the Easter season. And so part of that, what I'd like to do today, is spend a little bit of time looking at a text that even takes us before Easter, a text that if you're like me, you may not have spent a whole lot of time in, because it's the beginning of Matthew, and we're going to look at verses 1 through 16, and it's the genealogy passage that talks about who's the father of who and all of this and that. And most of us want to go right to Matthew 1:18, where it's the more familiar birth narrative of Jesus and those kinds of things. But what I'd like to do is just kind of take this day to set up we're entering into a new series over the next several weeks, and use this text as a framing text to kind of get us into our series and to talk a little bit about why the series is important and why we're approaching that. So kind of in lieu of that, let's go ahead and look at the passage. It's Matthew chapter 1, verses 1 through 16. Again, it's Matthew 1, verses 1 through 16. What I will do is, normally our tradition is to read it out loud, but there's 16 verses, it's quite a few. I'm going to read it, then I'll come back to you and ask for reflection, okay? So again, Matthew 1, verses 1 through 16. This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Perez, the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Amminadab. Amminadab, the father of Nahshon. Nahshon, the father of Salmon. Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse. And Jesse, the father of King David. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. Deep breath. Solomon, the father of Rehoboam, the father of Abijah. Abijah, the father of Asa. Asa, the father of Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat, the father of Jehoram. Jehoram, the father of Uzziah. Another breath. Uzziah, the father of Jotham. Jotham, the father of Ahaz. Ahaz, the father of Hezekiah. Hezekiah, the father of Manasseh. Manasseh, the father of Amon. Amon, the father of Josiah. Matthew didn't really believe in periods, apparently. And Josiah, the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the exile to Babylon. After the exile to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel. Shealtiel, the father of Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel, the father of Abiud. Abiud, the father of Eliakim. Eliakim, the father of Azor. Azor, the father of Zadok. Zadok, the father of Akim. Akim, the father of Eliud. Eliud, the father of Eleazar. Eleazar, the father of Mathan. Mathan, the father of Jacob. And Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary. And Mary was the mother of Jesus, who is called the Messiah. So first of all, something that should happen is you all should actually give me a round of applause just for making it through the names. It's pretty sad when I have to call for my own applause. Really interesting passage there. And, you know, originally when we were doing this, there's a worship team that gathers to talk about how we're going to do this sermon. And I said, well, I'd love to have someone stand up and read that. And they're like, oh, no one's going to read those names. That's all you. So that was all on me. I appreciate you letting me get through the 16 verses of names. So lots of names here. So-and-so is the father of so-and-so is the father of so-and-so is the father of so-and-so. The genealogy of Jesus. Matthew is trying to set a context. But before we talk about why that may be significant and some of the underlying things in that and how that relates to this series that Whitney mentioned we're going into, let me hear from you. What stands out to you? Yeah. Yeah, so the comment was it's an interesting kind of tension there because here you have a system, a patriarchal system that talks about here's the father and then we trace back Jesus' lineage through fathers there, but within Judaism, your kind of religious, cultural affiliation to Judaism is passed on through the mother. And so you have that reality, but then you have this connection in terms of naming the fathers. Yes. Good question. So what's the point of the genealogy tracing it back through Joseph here? It's not actually through Mary, through Joseph, given the fact that Joseph wasn't a part, isn't Jesus' father. Good question. Any other? Yeah.
What kind of the women that they do mention, or the Matthew does mention, are all incredible women of faith and have their own crazy stories of where God led them and what they did. So it's interesting that he pulls out those women. And what about all the other mothers and what's their story and why did he choose each one?
Okay, so within this passage, five women are mentioned, Mary, whom you would probably expect, but then you have four other women who are mentioned from the Old Testament, and why them? Why these four women? And so the comment actually is, if you look at those four women specifically, they have an interesting story in and of themselves, and why is it that Matthew mentions them? And once we hear their story, we might be interested. I mean, that's part of what we're going to unpack. Any other? Yeah, Larry. Okay, so, I mean, that's it, right? So other than Mary, are any of these women Jewish? I mean, there's some talk about whether they were or they weren't. Certainly, some of them weren't, like Ruth. She was a Moabite, so she's considered a Gentile there. So good point. Timothy.
I recognize a lot of the late names in the first two sections, but I don't recognize anybody, like Zadok or Azor or Akim.
You obviously haven't been reading your Bible enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just very weighty to think about entire 14 generations of people who I've never heard of, and I have no idea who they are.
Right, so who are these folks? And we recognize some of the names, some of the early names, and certainly through David, but then what happens, those names between David, that Davidic kingship into the exile, who are these folks? But yet there's something pretty cool about it. I mean, think about it. Essentially genealogies are nothing but family trees, and this is a theological attempt of creating a family tree that roots Jesus first back within the lineage of David the king, which was important for Jews, and then roots him in within the covenant family of Abraham, which would have been important for Jews. But who are these folks? They are folks, and there's something that's connected there. So, good point. Clay, was it your hand that I saw?
Goes against the grain of that
Yeah, so it's not just what your birthright is, but there is this connection to make it more real, and maybe that's the whole point in doing this. And then your first comment about just the names being very earthy. So if any of you are with child, go to Matthew 1, right, to see if you can, if you have a boy, do you want to put his name on there? Jeconiah, that's a great name these days. Any other comments? Yeah. Great point. So the genealogy that's listed in Matthew is a different genealogy than what is cited in Luke. And so what are the connections there? Good. We'll go one more time. Anyone else? All right. So as some of you have already noted, part of what's happening here in terms of what Matthew is trying to do. So Matthew, several of you probably already know, but Matthew is a book written specifically for Jews. I mean, Matthew is addressing a Jewish audience. And so the first thing he wants to do is he wants to say to them, okay, folks who are going to hear this, folks who will eventually read this, take note. This person that we are calling Messiah, before we even get into the birth of Messiah, understand that this Messiah didn't just appear from anywhere. This Messiah is rooted in the tradition and is rooted within this family of folks that who are familiar to us, that begins with Abraham, traces itself through David, and then Jesus, the Messiah, is a coming of David. It's within that lineage. Really important. And in fact, some translations refer to Matthew 1 as, rather than the genealogy of Jesus, talking about it as the origin of Jesus or the genesis of Jesus. Going back, alluding back to kind of Genesis 5:1, rooting it again within this very Jewish context. So I think that's important to remember. And I think what Matthew's trying to do here is to say, Jesus stands within this specific tradition, and for those of us, you're going to see, very soon we will kind of see who Jesus is, and as we understand his life and his teachings and all that, but first of all, what Matthew wants to say, that Jesus is Jewish. He wants us to come to grips with this. But then I think there is this surprising thing. So he's trying to build this case for his hearers to really kind of have a sense of what's happening, and so he does the lineage thing, and this wouldn't have been a very different thing for folks to hear, because part of building lineage, family trees, all of those kinds of things, it's you would gladly hear, or it would be familiar for you to hear that so-and-so is the father, so-and-so is the father, so-and-so. I mean, I kind of liken it to, for any of you that are Lord of the Ring fans, right? They did the same thing, right? This is Gimli, son of Gloin, and I don't remember who all the fathers are, but you are known by who your father is. So that wouldn't have been a weird thing to hear. But it's like in the midst of that, you're reading along, it's like, okay, I get this. He's starting to build this connection between the present and the past. And then all of a sudden you get to verse 3 and it's like, ah! Right? Because what does Matthew say? He says, Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. That would have stopped Jewish hearers in their tracks. What? Listing a woman? And then he goes on to say in verse 5, Salmon was the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz was the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. And then in verse 6, David was the father of Solomon, whose mother, she doesn't even get the dignity of her name, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. What is going on here? I think that's what would have been in the minds of those who were hearing this the first time. Because first of all, he's mentioning women as a part of the genealogy. And then, to the point that was made earlier, these aren't the kind of women that you would necessarily want to build your family tree on, right? So if it was me, and I was developing the family tree, I would build it in a much different way. I probably would have listed Sarah, who, I mean, she had kind of her own issues, but still, kind of a stalwart mom that we think of the faith. Or I might have mentioned Rachel, or I might have mentioned Leah, I might have mentioned Hannah. But he mentions these particular women. It's kind of like there's a friend of mine, and I love her. I love to hear her tell me her stories about her Uncle Cortez. And her Uncle Cortez is this he's like this crazy uncle, right? So he'll say to her someday, he'll need some money, and he'll like, hey, can I come by your house and paint your house for you for a few bucks? Well, my friend lives in a condominium, you know, so there's not going to be any outside painting going on. Or what he'll do sometimes, what he has done is, he's kind of this big guy, and he'll show up to her workplace, and he'll show up to the receptionist and say, I want to see my niece, but he's wrapped up in this bright blue boa, and sometimes he may have a bottle in his hand, and sometimes he may not, right? And so he's like, where's my niece? Call her right now. I need to see my niece. And the receptionist is like, oh my gosh. And before you laugh at my friend, we all have our Uncle Cortez's in our family, right? It may be an aunt, it may be a grandmother, whatever. And mentioning these four women, mentioning Tamar, mentioning Rahab, mentioning Ruth, mentioning Bathsheba, and not even mentioning her by name, is like building, what Matthew is saying is, here's Jesus' lineage. This is from where Jesus came, and then he throws in these four women, and just, we're going to explore these four women more throughout the weeks, but just to give you kind of a sense of it, a flavor of what's going on, right? Tamar, do you know her story in Genesis? She decides that she wants to fulfill the covenant promise, and she decides that she's going to take it in her own hands, and so she dresses up and acts like a prostitute in order to do that. So that's Tamar, right? So Rahab is actually a prostitute and decides she's going to align herself with God's people so that she can work with Joshua to help defeat the enemy, right? So that's Rahab. Ruth, she's this Moabite woman, this Gentile, who's supposed to go back. Her husband dies, and her mother-in-law tries to send her away, and she was like, no, I just, let me stay. She's just this Gentile woman, and Jesus is clearly, as we said earlier, Matthew's building his lineage on the fact that he's Jewish, and yet there's this Gentile Moabite in his history. And then finally, Bathsheba, who may be the most familiar to all of us, who, on the whim of a king, fathers Solomon, who becomes another king. So what you have is a woman who acts like a prostitute, who is a prostitute, who is a Gentile, who is an adulteress. That's where Matthew is building some of Jesus' ancestry. Again, if it was me, I probably would have said, you know, I might gloss over these women. And that's why I think it's for this very reason that I think it's important for us to unpack who these women are. Whitney mentioned that what we are doing is entering a sermon series called Neglected Women of the Faith. And part of what we want to do is ask the question, what is it about these four women that's significant enough to mention them as ancestors to Jesus? Why these four women? And we're going to explore their stories a little more. We're going to find out what it is about each of them that teaches us about what it may be, what it may mean to be people of God, and how does that play out for us. So the sermon series, as I've mentioned, is called Neglected Women of the Faith. So let's before we look at the four women, I mean, we'll do that in the ensuing weeks, let's talk about why this sermon series might be important. What does it have to say to us? Build some context for it. So first part is, if we're going to look at the title, well, what does it mean to be neglected? Any comments? If you hear the word neglected, what comes to your mind if you're going to define it for me? Forgotten? I heard something here. Yes? No? Okay. Anything else? Roadkill? Okay. Didn't necessarily come to my mind, but we'll go with that. Anything else? Yeah, Jill. Not worthy of attention. Great. So let me give you Webster's definition right where you all are. Neglect is defined as to give little attention or respect to disregard. Neglect implies giving insufficient attention to something that merits one's attention. In the everyday vernacular, roadkill, right? So this whole notion of neglected women of the faith, the first component is this. It's It's to bring us to a different reality. Just like the Jewish hearers back in Matthew's day, if they were sitting there and they were trying to listen to this, to the reading off of the lineage of Jesus, and where their minds would have stopped because they heard women, they heard the particular women whose stories they would have known, and they heard women's names, I think for us it gives us pause. Neglect, this thing that we should, that we normally gloss over, that we overlook, I think in this series, what we are being called to do is to say, in God's kingdom, within God's economy, those folks that are neglected are the folks that we should be paying attention to. And to me, we put this whole notion of neglect side by side with surprise, because I think within God's kingdom, what God is saying to us is those folks who are neglected, who we don't pay any attention to, who we gloss over, those are the folks that can surprise us, because they're the folks that I can do something significant with. So neglect should actually be tempered with this whole notion of surprise. What is it that God wants to say to us about these folks that it's easy for us to neglect, but yet God has something amazing in store? Neglected. Then the second part of the title of the series is Neglected Women of the Faith. If we look at the context and we look at the social reality during the biblical times, in the Old Testament, and then also in the New Testament, I wonder if the whole notion of saying neglected women is a redundancy. Do you understand that women back in that time had no freestanding value? They didn't have any worth. They were very rarely even acknowledged outside of their connection to their husbands, or maybe even in connection to their kids. And so, again, for them to get mentioned in this lineage is a big deal. Men could divorce their wives. Wives couldn't divorce their husbands. It's that kind of reality. And so, in some ways, to talk about neglected women of the faith is to say that because they are women, they are absolutely neglected. They are absolutely overlooked. There is absolutely no reason to pay attention to what's going on. But like I just mentioned, I think what God is calling us to do is to say, hold on. Within the kingdom, we operate from a different value system. And because they are neglected, and because they are women, we probably should be paying attention. I think that's why this sermon series is so important. At least it's why it's motivating me. It's really this recognition that what exists outside of the kingdom must be reversed so that we can truly acknowledge that the God who created us male and female. And if that's the God who created us, then what else can God do through us in terms of bringing salvation history through Jesus, but rooted in the context of these four women who normally get overlooked? But that's a conversation that kind of exists out here, right? It's this conversation that exists for folks to talk about. And there's lots of conversations within the church and outside of the church about what the role of women is. I'd like to spend a few moments to kind of root the conversation in the context of our particular community. Here at Jacob's Well, what does that look like? And my first point is, I think we are called into this conversation just by nature of our name, right? Jacob's Well. Jacob's Well, the place where Jesus encounters a woman that society wants to push to the end at Sychar, he takes a moment to talk with her, whereas the rest of society wants to marginalize her. And so when we think about neglected women of the faith, why are we having this conversation? By virtue of our name, it pulls us into this dialogue and this conversation to see what it is, that how God would look at people in a different way than how folks normally look at folks. So we're involved in this conversation from the very beginning. That's part of who we are. The second thing I want to acknowledge is we, as a community, we are a people that have been standing alongside those who've been neglected for a while. You know that we've been involved in the Not For Sale movement. We brought in David Batstone to kind of speak to us about human trafficking. And you understand that in the whole notion of human trafficking, when we talk about human trafficking and sex slaves, we're talking about primarily about women who get trafficked overseas and here. And one of the commitments our community has made is to say, you know what, we're going to be an abolitionist church. That means that here in Kansas City, if women are trafficked and the police go into a place and they find that women have been trafficked, we've said that those women can stay here for a period of time until they're safe, until we can find more permanent housing. So we've been engaged in that. And lots of us have been involved in this sort of thing. Lots of us have been pursuing it. We've been reading. We've been trying to do things around it. We have been engaged in standing alongside those folks who are neglected and marginalized because they are women in ways that aren't happening in other places. And that's an amazing thing. So we are engaged in this conversation. I do think, though, one of the things that God asks us to do, in addition to those kinds of things, and we should acknowledge that the things that we're doing, the conversations we're already having are important. But one of the other things that God calls us to do is to say, what else? Is there more? What about the leadership here at Jacob's Well? Does it reflect the kingdom? Or does it reflect a reality in which women may be neglected? And so let me just say to you up front, I think in some ways we do a pretty good job. So for instance, our church is governed by a board of elders. There are 10 folks on that board of elders. 3 of them are women. Two of them have been engaged in the conversation and been a part of the governance structure for a long time. One has been brought on this past fall, this past year, brand new, but they have been really involved. So in some ways, as it relates to leadership in terms of who we are as a church and what we say, and we say we value women's role in the church and they have the ability to lead, we have been doing that. But then I also have to acknowledge that as a pastor in this community, I'm one of 5 folks who shares the title of pastor. And of those 5, we're all male. What does that mean? Does it mean that the leadership in this church has been malicious about kind of not allowing women to participate in the conversation? I don't think that. Does it mean, though, that we might have to be more intentional in terms of pursuing and looking at how we engage and involve women in the conversation in all levels, particularly in the pastoral theological conversations that exist there? Perhaps. Actually, I'll say it a little stronger. I think so. That's part of why I think it's important to have this conversation. And before you mishear me, let me be really clear about what I'm not saying. I'm not suggesting that here at Jacob's Well, what we should do would be to create some sort of a quota system where we say, here are the men in leadership, here are the women in leadership, it has to be equal. I'm not looking for numerical equality. I'm not looking to generate some sort of PC movement that says, well, let's look at everything we do and make sure we have equal numbers. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is that I think God, in his kingdom, has asked us to look at those who have been marginalized, kicked to the sides, have been overlooked, and because of that, just like in the text that we saw with Matthew, because of these women whose stories have been neglected, but they have had some amazing things to say, and they are a part of the lineage of Jesus Christ, our Savior. I think because of that, then what we need to do is continue to look at how we live life, how we organize our community, how we live together. And I wonder if there might be ways that we can be instructed in that as well. So this isn't about trying to create some kind of existence that reverts to out there. It's about living by values in which God continually surprises us because the stories of the people that he brings to us and he works through amaze us time after time after time. Kind of one final note on this. Some of you out there, the men, might be thinking to yourself, oh, great. We're going to do a series about women. Okay, this is a good time for me to just check out. Certainly you can do that. You might actually even be here and check out mentally, and I wouldn't know. Well, I can kind of tell in your eyes. I'll tell a couple of you later. I don't think that that's the reality that God is calling us to. If, again, to go back to the Matthew passage, it didn't start off, this is the genealogy of Jesus Christ through David, through Abraham, only for women to read. The whole notion of understanding where we place women, neglected women, within our tradition, within our community, it's something that we all need to hear. Because the reality is, we are a community. And what we're trying to discover is how we can make this community more whole, how we can understand what God wants for us, all of us, not just a few of us. If you don't believe Matthew on this, let's look at what Paul has to say about it. Comes out of 1 Corinthians 12, verses 12 through 14, and then 21 through 26. The body is a unit. Though it is made up of many parts, and though all of its parts are many, they form one body. So it is with Christ. For we were all baptized by one Spirit into one body, whether Jews or Greeks, slaves or free, I would include for our context, men or women, and we were all given the one Spirit to drink. Now, the body is not made up of one part, but of many. The eye cannot say to the hand, I don't need you. And the head cannot say to the feet, I don't need you. On the contrary, those parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. And the parts that we think are less honorable, we treat with special honor. And the parts that are unpresentable are treated with special modesty, while our presentable parts need no special treatment. But God has combined the members of the body and has given greater honor to the parts that lacked it, so that there should be no division in the body, but that its parts should have equal concern for each other. If one part suffers, every part suffers with it. If one part is honored, every part rejoices with it. So part of what Paul is saying is this isn't just a message for a particular segment of the population. We are one body, and the fact that we are one body, we need to hear this message together. And as we hear this message together, what we need to take from it is how can we be a more whole body? Acknowledging that there are different strengths each of us brings to it, acknowledging that there are times when we're not going to honor the body. But if we are one community, one body within the auspice of our Messiah, Jesus Christ, then what we have to realize is that in those moments and in those times when we neglect folks, particularly as it relates to this series, if we neglect women, that doesn't honor the body. I think there's going to be a lot that's instructive for us as we continue through this series. Really excited about it. Part of it is because it's exploring new territory for me theologically. I've not spent any amount of time unpacking who these women are and what their story is for us. So I'm excited about that. I think it has a lot to say for us. I think it will edify us as a community, our one body. But I have to be really honest with you and say that there are good theological reasons, there are biblical reasons why this is important, but then for me, there are personal reasons. And I just want to put that on the table so you understand why this is important for me. First one is, my mom is my theological, my spiritual role model. She's a person who came to faith late in her life, but even before she professed Christ, she was this woman who knew what it meant to be hospitable, who knew what it meant to be compassionate, who knew what it meant to be gracious and to engage with folks. And she taught me vulnerability, and she taught me strength, and she taught me what it meant to live life, to engage in a way that was just amazing to me. What I saw in her was like, that's who I want to be. My mom passed away when I was 16, and I think from the time that I was 16 to later in life, it was like, I need to have role models like that, and I was in search of a role model that I probably didn't find until I met my wife. So for me, this whole notion of women who have something to contribute and to say to the life of a body, to other folks of faith, that's really personal to me. The second reason why it's so important, I'm the dad of three girls, right? And I mean, you all are laughing, and you understand that I want my girls to understand that as they grow up to be Christian girls and then women, that what they understand is that there is a story for them, there is a place for them, there is a role for them in this community. It's my daughter and I, actually Imani, who's five, and Verena, who's 2.5. One of the things that we've been doing lately is they love to watch Dancing with the Stars. I mean, I just love that. So we'll do Dancing with the Stars. And so what Imani will say to me is, she'll say, "Dad, who's learning, the boy or the girl?" And I'll say, "Well, the boy is learning this time." And then she'll say, "Well, who's learning this time, the boy or the girl?" And I'll say, "Well, the boy is learning this time." So we'll be watching it, and then Imani will turn to me, and she'll say, "I want the girl to win." This year, she's not as excited about the folks, but last season, she was totally excited about the cheetah girl. She wanted the cheetah girl to win, and she was very upset when the cheetah girl got voted off and she felt like she got jobbed, that whole bit. You have to go back and watch the show and see how all that plays out. But she'll say, "Dad, I want the girl to win." And I'll look at her and I'll say, "Well, sweetie, why? Why do you want the girl to win?" And she'll look up at me, and told you that she's five, but she's like five going on 15. She'll look at me and she's like, "Because, Dad, I'm a girl." And I think what I want for my daughters is to understand that they don't have to be apologetic, that they're girls, that within this community, and then within the broader community that is God's kingdom, that they won't be neglected, that they will be honored, and that they could actually be role models for other folks. And so as we enter this series, I think part of how we're entering is to say, God, what is it that you're teaching us? What is it that you want to say to us to say, how can we continue to strengthen our body through the stories of these four women? Let's pray.